I thought. But when we went on the outside, it was a big old thing sticking in the roof of my apartment. Debris from off somebody else's apartment. It was jabbed into the roof of my apartment, just like a needle, but it's a big needle.
Mary, who's 69, would love to be back in her apartment, but it's not safe. In a nearby Rowlett suburb, Sabrina Lowe says she was luckier because of her faith. 10 relatives were at her home when the tornado threatened.
We actually went outside and started commanding the winds because God had given us authority over the winds, the airways. And we just began to command this storm not to hit our area. We spoke to the storm and said, go to unpopulated places. It did exactly what we said to do because God gave us the authority to do that.
Others weren't so lucky or blessed. Officials say as many as 1,000 North Texas homes were damaged or destroyed. Garland was the hardest hit. Meteorologists say a powerful tornado hit the town with winds exceeding 200 miles an hour. For NPR News, I'm Bill Zeebel in Dallas.
Now let's reflect on a year of political storms. We discussed some of it in recent days with President Obama. In a year-end interview, he spoke of everything from his strategy against ISIS to Donald Trump.
This morning, we have one more part of that conversation in which we asked the president questions about questions. The president did something unusual this year. He sat for interviews in which he posed the questions. He interviewed 18-year-old Noah McQueen for the NPR series StoryCorps.
So you had gotten in repeated trouble. And what happened?
I went to a Christian retreat.
Did you say to yourself, man, I need to find something different and go to a Christian retreat?
Oh, no, sir. I didn't want to go at all. My mom forced me.
Oh, okay. So mama intervened. Said, Lord, please help my knucklehead son Noah straighten out.
This was only one time the president chose to pose the questions. On British TV, he interviewed naturalist David Attenborough.
What are the prospects for this blue marble that we live on?
If they don't understand about the workings of the natural world.
Later, the president was interviewing a novelist, Marilyn Robinson, in the New York Review of Books. At an Asia-Pacific summit, he interviewed a Chinese billionaire. It is hard to think of other presidents who've done this so publicly. And when we asked him about it, what we heard was a president thinking out loud about his job.
Final question, Mr. President.
Yeah.
And it's a question about questions. You've questioned people, interviewed people. Why are you doing that?
You know, one of the best things about this job is that you can talk to anybody. You know, it turns out you pick up the phone. If somebody's doing something interesting, something that inspires you, you can usually get them to take your phone call. And you know, sometimes I do it to learn myself what is it that you know, makes them tick and what can they teach me about the world. Sometimes I just want to shine a light on somebody who I think is extraordinary. You know, when I talked to that young teenager, that high school kid.
18-year-old African-American.
You know, here's a guy who was on the streets and going down the wrong path and you know, most likely would have ended up in jail if you looked at the odds. And he was able, through faith and some timely intervention, to completely turn his life around and was on his way to college. And, you know, at a time where popular culture often portrays young African-American men coming from low-income neighborhoods as a danger, I wanted people to hear what an extraordinary kid this was and how much he was like a lot of teenage boys who just may be growing up in more forgiving environments. The novelist Marilyn Robinson, you know, she's become a friend of mine. I just love her books. And I think she says something about the essential decency and goodness of the American people. The folks she writes about are, you know, from the Midwest and small towns and are rooted in you know, flags and apple pie and Americana, and yet they've got these really complicated lives. And what she says about our democracy and what's best in us, I thought was important for people to hear.
If you had an opportunity to ask a question to the people who want your job, which maybe you could, one of these debates you could write in on Facebook that asked your question, what would you ask?
You know, That's a great question, Steve, and I might have to give it some thought, but what I can tell you, I ask myself every single day is, how can I be useful in creating an America that is more tolerant, more prosperous, provides greater opportunity, is safer? And so I might just ask somebody, why do you want to do this? And I suppose they'd give a cliche answer because that's what candidates do. But I will tell you, as president, if you're interested just because you like the title, or you like the trappings, or you like the power, or the fame, or the celebrity, that side of it wears off pretty quick. At least it has for me. And what sustains me, what lasts, what makes me happy, proud, frustrated sometimes, is the recognition that if you want this job, then you really need to love this country and have a very clear vision and idea of what it is that you want to do to help make this country work even better. And I don't think this country works best on fear. I don't think this country works best on hate. I don't think this country works best on cynicism. I think this country works best on community and hope and optimism and dynamism and change. You know, if you're aspiring to this job, then you need to ask yourself some very serious questions about why you're doing it, because that's what's going to keep you going on those days that things aren't going so well.
Mr. President, thanks as always for your time.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
That's part of our year-end talk with President Obama. There is new video of this final portion of the talk, as well as video of our talk released last week about ISIS, the president's legacy, Donald Trump, and more. You can find the videos on social media and at NPR.org.
And that is not quite our final political interview of 2015. You heard Obama's question to presidential candidates, why do you want to do this? Well, on Thursday, New Year's Eve, we will hear from one of those presidential hopefuls. It's a New Year's conversation with Republican Jeb Bush of Florida. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:18. Thanks for tuning in to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have the latest news for you coming up next from NPR and WPR. And still to come this hour, standardized testing was one of the top education issues of the year. A look at what's ahead for 2016 with the new federal education law. Hear that story in about 20 minutes here on WPR.
Local musicians, get your music on the radio on WGTD's Noon Tunes. It airs Monday through Friday on the WGTD Midday News. Email Dave McGrath at mcgrathd@gtc.edu.
Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support free, family-friendly events. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Chicago police have once again come under intense scrutiny after two people were fatally shot by officers this weekend. Relatives of the victims are criticizing what they say is a culture of shoot first, ask questions later. Linda Letton from member station WBEZ reports.
Chicago police killed a 19-year-old engineering student and his downstairs neighbor, a mother of five, over the holiday weekend. Police shot and critically injured a third person in Chicago in a separate domestic dispute. All the victims were African American. The U.S. Department of Justice is already reviewing Chicago's police department for potential excessive use of force and racial bias.
WBEZ's Linda Ludden. Germany's transportation minister is calling for drug, alcohol, and medical spot checks for pilots in the country. NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson says the measure is in response to a German Wings crash last March that prosecutors say was caused by the co-pilot.
Transportation Minister Alexander Dobrindt told the Bild am Sonntag newspaper that making the spot checks would have a positive effect on air travel. He says airlines should be responsible for carrying out the random examinations, but the German Pilots Union says it would unfairly place pilots under suspicion. Dobrindt nevertheless plans to introduce the measure to the full German cabinet next year.
NPR Soraya Sahardi-Nelson reporting. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. A state lawmaker wants to see if a summer reading program at Milwaukee's Marquette University can benefit students statewide. A bill from Assembly Republican Joe Sanfilippo of New Berlin would give $1.1 million to the Marquette program over the next 2 years as a pilot project. School reform leader and former Milwaukee superintendent Howard Fuller heads the six-week summer program, which started after officials discovered that Wisconsin's African-American students had the nation's fourth lowest reading scores in 2010. Up to 97% in each year's program have improved their skills in things like phonics and vocabulary. The Assembly Education Committee has endorsed Sanfilippo's bill, but Milwaukee Democrat Mandela Barnes says the state should take competitive bids for the program. Green Bay's mayor has a plan to attract attention to the city's downtown on New Year's Eve. He's going to have a llama wear a sash and march across a bridge. The Green Bay Press Gazette reports that Mayor Jim Schmidt recently explained his newly concocted myth, the legend of the lucky llama. He says all who see the creature walk across the Ray Nitschke Memorial Bridge at around 8:45 on December 31st will receive blessings and good fortune. The llama will cross the bridge before a fireworks show over the Fox River. Schmidt says he hopes his llama catches on and becomes a tradition. There's a winter storm warning in effect for practically all of Wisconsin. Up to 6 to 10 inches are expected in some parts.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, Japanese maker of full-body massage chairs, including the Flex 3S with pre-programmed shiatsu massages and full-body stretch sessions. At InadaUSA.com, that's InadaUSA.com. From LifeLock, reminding consumers that while shopping online or in stores this holiday season, a trail of personal information is left behind, increasing risk of identity theft. More at LifeLock.com. And from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. An idea for cancer treatment that helped Jimmy Carter is older than he is. The former president is 91. He announced recently that his advanced melanoma had been successfully treated. He credited an immunotherapy drug, which does not directly kill cancer cells, instead boosting the patient's immune system to do the job. It is cutting-edge cancer treatment, although the idea behind it dates back more than a century. NPR's Rebecca Davis reports.
In the late summer of 1890, surgeon William Coley prepared to examine a new patient. What he didn't know at the time was this young woman would change his life and the future of cancer research.
Her name was Elizabeth Dashiell, known as Bessie Dashiell.
Dr. David B. Levine is director of archives at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. He says 17-year-old Bessie had injured her hand. It seemed like a simple bump, but it kept getting worse and worse.
She had a lot of pain, and nobody could diagnose what the problem was.
At first, Dr. Coley thought Bessie must have an infection. But when he took a biopsy,
it turned out to be this cancer, a very malignant cancer, a very advanced cancer.
A kind of cancer called sarcoma. Stephen Hall, author of A Commotion in the Blood, says there wasn't very much Dr. Coley could do for Bessie.
You have to remember this is prior to radiation therapy, prior to chemotherapy, and he didn't typically treat cancer patients. He was a general surgeon.
So Dr. Coley did the only thing he could. He amputated.
Right arm just below the elbow.
Hoping, says David Levine, to stop the spread of the cancer.
Within a month, she had widespread metastasis of her cancer to her lungs, her liver, and all over her body.
There was nothing to do but wait for the end. When the time came, Dr. Coley stayed by Bessie's side.
On January 23, 1891, she died.
It was an ugly death and a painful one. Stephen Hall says it made a huge impression on Coley.
He's still a young surgeon. He's in his 20s. He sees this seemingly healthy young woman come in, and within the course of several months, her body is completely overtaken by this malignant disease. It really shocked him.
And it spurred him into action. There wasn't a lot known about cancer at the time, so Coley started digging through dozens upon dozens of old hospital records, looking for something that would help him understand this cruel and aggressive disease. Stephen Hall.
As a student, he had read Darwin, and one of the lessons he took away from Darwin was always pay attention to exceptions to the rule. When there's a biological exception to a rule, ask yourself why this has happened.
Coley discovered one of these biological exceptions. It was the case of a German immigrant named Fred Stein. Stein had been a cancer patient at the hospital 8 years earlier. Doctors had removed a cancerous growth, a sarcoma, from his neck. But the tumor kept coming back. And then Stein contracted a serious bacterial infection of the skin. David Levine says his days were numbered.
Only Stein didn't die. His infection subsided, and along with that, his mass, which was large, disappeared. And he was discharged from New York Hospital.
Coley wondered if all these years later, Stein could still be alive. It was the winter of 1891 when William Coley the surgeon became William Coley the detective. He headed for the tenements of the Lower East Side of Manhattan, knocking on door after door, asking for a man named Fred Stein with a distinctive scar across his neck. After several weeks of searching, Coley found him, alive and cancer-free. But why? Why did Fred Stein's cancer go away and stay away after getting a bacterial infection?
Coley speculated that the strep infection could reverse cancer.
And if that were the case, then what would happen if he tried to reproduce that effect on purpose, if he deliberately injected cancer patients with a bacteria? Coley decided to test his idea on the most seriously ill patients. He started with an Italian immigrant named Zola, a man who, just like Bessie Dashiell, was suffering from sarcoma, with life-threatening tumors riddling his throat. Coley armed himself with a good supply of the strep bacteria, and his experiment began. Stephen Hall.
This process went on for months. You know, he would create little cuts and rub the bacteria in it, and there'd be a slight response, but not really too much.
And then Coley got his hands on a much stronger strain of the bacteria, and this time Zola got violently ill. The infection could easily have killed him.
But Coley then describes this tumor, in this case, I think it was, they described it as the size of an orange, almost within 24 hours, beginning to decrease in size, sort of liquefy, and kind of disintegrate. This was the phenomenon that seemed to occur very rarely, but nonetheless, when you saw it, you were utterly astonished.
Zola completely recovered, and Coley knew he was onto something. He kept experimenting and refining his use of bacteria. Eventually, he named the treatment Coley's Toxins. It was an exciting time. Coley was having tremendous success, and he was celebrated in America and abroad. But Bradley Coley Jr., William Coley's grandson, says the American medical establishment at the time was skeptical.
It was a hard sell, especially when nobody knew how it worked, including my grandfather, by the way.
Because the immune system was still a mystery, and the results couldn't be replicated with any consistency. Then in the early 1900s, along came radiation, and this would be the treatment medicine embraced. William Coley remained committed to his toxins, but they were largely overshadowed.
When he died, all interest in it stopped.
And quite possibly, that's where Coley's legacy could have ended, except for this. After his death in 1936, his daughter, Helen Coley Knotts, started looking through hundreds and hundreds of her father's cases, and she found he'd had some extraordinary rates of success using Coley's toxins to make certain cancers go away. But she couldn't get anyone interested in studying her father's work, so she decided to do it herself. In 1953, with a modest grant, she started up the Cancer Research Institute, an organization that helped create a whole new field dedicated to understanding the immune system and its relationship to cancer. A dedication that has been key in making immunotherapy the promising treatment it is today. Rebecca Davis, NPR News.
Support for your health comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing a range of in-home senior care services with an individualized approach. More at homeinstead.com/NPR.
This is NPR News.
Like a trail of breadcrumbs, what we do on the internet gives companies a picture of who we are and what we want. But what if everything we write on the web provided insights into our personality?
Unconsciously, the choice of words that we make as we express ourselves truly does reflect who we are.
Mining our words to understand our personalities later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered at 3 this afternoon here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep with another step forward for reality TV. A woman in the country of Georgia wanted to compete in a televised singing contest, which was hard since she was in prison for robbery. But the BBC reports prison officials sent her to the studio under armed guard. And though she did not win, the country's prisons minister appeared beside her and told her there on TV she was being released on parole. She said she would seize this chance to start her life anew. It's Morning Edition.
It's 8:31 and you've tuned in to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you're having a great Monday so far. Stay with us. Still to come this hour, it was a big year in paid leave policies, especially among private companies. Some cities and states have also passed bills to expand parental leave ahead of Congress, which is considering the Family Act. Hear more on that story in about 15 minutes here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, providing professional construction services to customers in a variety of markets nationwide for more than 125 years. More about markets served, featured projects, and news is at bolt.com.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market. The market opens Saturdays during the cold weather season in the atrium of the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha is currently on break. It'll reopen Saturday, January 9th. For more, visit KenoshaHarborMarket.com.
Ever wondered who's in charge of the confetti that swirls around the ball drop on New Year's Eve?
And I very calmly then say, go confetti, go confetti, go confetti.
It's that guy. I'm Adrienne Hill, New York City on New Year's Eve. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Catch Marketplace at 6:30 tonight here on Wisconsin Public Radio. There's a winter storm warning in effect for almost all of Wisconsin. Snow, freezing rain, and sleet are expected to fall through tomorrow. There should be 6 to 10 inches in some parts of the state. Highs will reach the 20s for the most part, except a bit warmer near Lake Michigan at around 30 degrees. For tomorrow, snow and light freezing rain will continue through the day, and a slight chance of light freezing drizzle in the afternoon and evening, highs near 30.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people from diverse backgrounds and ensure that they reach their fullest potential. More information is available at wtgrantfoundation.org. From Heather and Paul Haga, supporting Salzburg Global Seminar, committed to helping tomorrow's leaders forge solutions today. More information is available online at salzburgglobal.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. It's been a high-stakes year for high-stakes standardized tests taken by students in public schools. The debate over the new federal education law, the Every Student Succeeds Act, turned in part on whether annual testing would remain a federal mandate. Ultimately, the overhaul passed with the test still in place. On the other hand, this fall, President Obama released a testing action plan. He's calling for states to cut down unnecessary testing that creates, quote, undue stress for educators and students. For more on the changes we're likely to see in school testing in 2016, we turned to Anya Kamenetz of the NPR Ed team, who's been following these issues very closely. Good morning.
Hi, Renee.
And annual tests are still in place, so what's different now?
What's really different are the stakes. So instead of the federal government, as it did under No Child Left Behind, mandating that every single child perform at grade level and dictating the sanctions for schools where students are following behind, now every state can pretty much set up its own plan for improving schools. And at the same time, states are encouraged a little bit to de-emphasize test scores in their accountability formulas in favor of multiple measures of student success, like behavior, attendance, graduation rates, even student surveys.
It sounds a little bit more relaxed, but does that mean testing and test prep is likely to fade?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, the Department of Education and the president have been putting out the message that there's too much testing, and they're certainly responding to the public in that way, and they're providing resources in this bill for states to audit and to streamline their testing programs. The problem is that many, many districts have to wait sometimes for months before they get their state test scores. So they still need to give their own diagnostic tests in order to get information they can use in the classroom. And as long as test scores remain linked to accountability measures, districts will still want to give benchmark and practice tests and spend time prepping students. And it's all this district-level testing and the prepping that really does seem to pile up and add to the stress on students.
And how exactly does the Common Core relate to all of this testing?
Well, you know, I think of a lot of the stress isn't just around the sheer number of tests, but also around all the changes in state policies. And the Common Core, of course, is really central to that. So initially, as part of the run-up to the Common Core, boosters said that if states adopted the same standards and just a handful of aligned tests, that we would simplify testing and get scores that we could compare across states. But that hasn't happened. Instead, there's been a really chaotic process of states picking up and dropping the standards, picking up and dropping various tests. And according to a report this year, 65% of the biggest school districts in the country saw a change in their big state tests in the last 5 years. So not only can we not compare performance across many, many states, the same districts can't compare their own performance to 5 years ago.
And what about the politics of testing? Because this has become quite politicized. Will the opt-out movement continue to grow?
You know, even as the opt-out movement has been running high last spring in states like New York, national polls reported that a majority of Americans don't support sitting kids out of mandated tests. And one important political change in the new federal law is that states no longer have to make test scores a central part of teacher evaluations. And it was this one issue, the linking of test scores to teacher evaluations, that really mobilized teacher unions in particular against tests. And so I think that even if the new law doesn't cut back on testing, it may have effectively neutralized some of the opposition to testing.
Anya, thanks very much.
Thanks, Renee.
Anya Kamenetz of the NPR Ed Team.
And now let's take a moment to remember one of the greatest American artists of the past century. Ellsworth Kelly died at home on Sunday at age 92. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports on Kelly's life and on the art he leaves behind.
Ellsworth Kelly started his artistic career in France, but not wearing a beret and standing behind an easel. He was in a U.S. Army uniform during World War II. Kelly served in a special unit made mostly of artists. Their job was to fool the Germans into thinking there were more Allied forces than there actually were. Kelly told NPR in 2007 they did it partly by building fake tanks and trucks from wood and burlap.
But later, they were made in rubber, inflatable, and they looked like the real thing.
After the war, Kelly lived in Paris. Art historian Sarah Rich says he'd walk around snapping photographs.
Not photographs of famous places like the Eiffel Tower or anything like that, but photographs just of an alleyway.
Or a plain old window, or the side of an unassuming building.
And would see in that photograph a square.
Kelly would use that black square as the basis of a painting. Now, you don't need a photo to paint a black square. You just need a ruler. But Ellsworth Kelly wanted to bring scraps of the world almost mystically onto his canvas. He boiled shadows and shapes down into abstractions, monochromes, just one really strong, pure, bright color. Kelly said that came from his boyhood in New Jersey, surrounded by nature.
I've always been a colorist, I think. I started when I was very young. Being a bird watcher, fascinated by the bird colors.
The way Kelly used colors made them feel almost alive. Just to face a giant red rectangle by Ellsworth Kelly is to come to red in a fresh and profound way.
I feel that I like color in its strongest sense. Red, yellow, blue, black, and white was what I started with.
When Kelly moved to New York in the 1950s, abstract expressionism was all the rage. He did not fit in, says Sarah Rich, with all the cooler-than-cool artists flinging painted canvases, or dripping it, or standing in it.
He was really not interested in their corny expressionism and epic self-importance. All of that stuff just seemed burdensome and dull.
Forging a new aesthetic language in that environment was not easy, Kelly said.
It was a very hard job, doing it all myself, getting to where I am.
Where Ellsworth Kelly was when he died was a universally recognized master of contemporary art. He influenced minimalism and pop art with his bold, spare paintings, drawings, and sculptures, which are in virtually every major museum of modern art. When Ellsworth Kelly was 90, NPR asked what he enjoyed most about being very old.
Oh, dear. I feel like I'm 20 in my head. My painting makes me feel good, and I just feel like I can live on. If you just keep doing, keep working, that maybe that's possible.
Ellsworth Kelly came about as close as anyone could to making that possibility real. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
On the final Monday of the year, it's Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:41. Thanks for tuning in to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have the latest news for you in just a couple minutes with headlines from NPR and WPR. And then in 10 minutes on Marketplace Morning Report, what if the sweater Santa gave you was too large? We'll look at the millions of packages returned each year after Christmas. That plus all the morning's business news in 10 minutes here on WPR.
Lift your spirit and enrich your mind with Wisconsin Public Television's performance, art, and drama offerings. Satisfy your curiosity with Wednesday night science programs and learn more through weekend how-to broadcasts. Go to WPT.org for detailed broadcast information, and while there, sign up for an e-newsletter about upcoming broadcasts and events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Iraqi troops were shown waving flags and brandishing machine guns after retaking key areas of Ramadi. The Islamic State group took over the city in May. It's the Iraqi army's first victory against ISIS since June of last year. Parts of the Midwest are under a winter storm warning. The latest round of severe weather is expected to bring blizzard-like conditions, making the commute difficult in many states today.
Travel is going to be treacherous, whether it's due to ice or snow or wind blowing things around. So if you have travel plans that can be delayed, I would definitely recommend delaying them.
National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Lee. Weather conditions have closed most of Interstate 40 from Albuquerque, New Mexico, east across the Texas Panhandle. Several days of tornadoes and other severe weather have killed at least 43 people in several states. Seoul and Tokyo say they've reached an agreement to resolve a contentious historical dispute. Korean Kong has more.
Comfort women is a euphemism for World War II sex slaves in Japanese military-run brothels. Many of them were Korean. For years, Korea demanded proper compensation from Japan. Japan replied that it has apologized numerous times, a claim Korea rejected as insufficient.
Karine Kong reporting from Seoul. U.S. stocks opened lower to kick off the final week of 2015. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 87 points, the Nasdaq down 21. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 6:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. With an eye on a multi-million dollar windfall from excess Lambeau Field taxes, Green Bay leaders are considering whether to contribute toward an amphitheater for the city's botanical garden. The project was one of 16 ideas pitched at a recent meeting for how the city should spend its $5.3 million payout, and WLUK-TV reports that city council members consider it a viable option. The 1,500-seat concert venue is the centerpiece of a $4 million proposed update. Garden officials did not ask for a specific dollar amount at the listening session. The council hopes to start making decisions for how to spend the money by March. A wintry mix of snow, ice, gusty winds, and freezing rain is expected to make travel difficult in most parts of Wisconsin this afternoon through tomorrow. The National Weather Service issued a winter storm warning
for a large portion of the state. Inland areas are expected to see the most snow accumulation, with totals possibly reaching a foot in the northwest, 5 to 10 inches in south-central counties, and 2 inches along the Lake Michigan shoreline. Forecasters say the precipitation will accumulate overnight, with strong winds of 25 to 50 miles per hour. The storm warning remains in effect until tomorrow morning. Temperatures today should reach the highs of the mid-20s, except a bit warmer near Lake Michigan at 30 degrees. For tomorrow in Wisconsin, there is a chance of snow and light freezing rain through the day. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health, enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives, now and for generations to come. On the web at rwjf.org. And from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Paid family leave is something that's not widely available to most American workers, though this year, that started to change. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more.
Heather Reams worked at an Alexandria, Virginia nonprofit when her daughter was born 6 years ago. There was no official maternity leave policy, and 2 months after giving birth, she started getting emails from the office.
I was a little bit taken aback that I was asked to come back. I ended up feeling the pressure and coming back at week 10.
Reams eventually left after being told no more maternity leaves in the future. When she started looking for a new job, she wanted an employer that offered maternity leave and
had good benefits, that was clear in its policy.
Looking at the expansions in leave policies now, Reams says she wishes it had been available to her.
I would have certainly taken advantage of all the paid leave that I could get.
Vicki Shabo is vice president of the National Partnership for Women and Families.
We are in a tremendously different place than 12 months ago.
Earlier this year, Netflix, Nestle, Marriott, and Hilton all expanded their leave policies. This month, eBay did, and before that, Credit Suisse.
The week before that, around Thanksgiving, Facebook announced the 4-month paid leave for all new parents across the globe. The week before that, Spotify announced 6 months of paid leave. The week before that, Zillow announced 16 weeks of maternity leave and 8 weeks of paternity leave.
But for all the high-profile announcements, only a small minority of U.S. workers get paid leave. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says only 75% of full-time workers have paid sick leave, and only 13% have paid family leave. Shabo says some of those companies said the benefits would apply to their hourly as well as their salaried employees. But for the most part, it's a benefit that applies to white-collar workers. Tom Spiegel, a Virginia employment attorney, agrees.
For many parents, leave, if it's not paid leave, is not leave because they can't afford to be without a paycheck.
He says historically, federal policy led the way in expanding parental leave. Now it's states and cities. 3 states have paid leave laws, and more are considering them. Portland and Seattle already require employers with workers in those cities to offer paid leave. Most notably, he says, in Washington, D.C., the city council is considering a bill to give workers in the city 16 weeks of paid family leave.
It's such a broad law, and it provides so many protections. It could be a game changer for this kind of legislation.
Many experts say there's a shift taking place and that it's generational. Millennials in their childbearing years are demanding work-life balance, which is forcing companies to adjust. Take, for example, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's recent decision to take 2 months of paternity leave. Many prospective parents, however, are not able to set their own terms. Georgine Huang was job hunting early in her pregnancy 2 years ago and felt sheepish about asking about maternity leave during interviews.
I certainly didn't feel like I could ask the question, you know, what is your leave policy? Because I felt that that was risking too much in terms of potentially being stigmatized or just viewed negatively.
So she co-founded a site called Fairy Godboss, where women could anonymously post about their experiences with employers, including maternity leave. Huang, who is 35, says she feels younger women are less afraid to ask the question.
The younger you are, the more willing you are to challenge the status quo.
And she says that's why she believes the status quo is in flux. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and you've tuned in to Wisconsin Public Radio. The music starts in 10 minutes, and today's highlights include one of Beethoven's piano concertos and one of Bach's Brandenburg concertos, plus a piece for solo harp. Join Stephanie Elkins for Morning Classics at 9, right after the Marketplace Morning Report, which is next here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
Explore radical robots and gadgets galore. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support science exploration and education. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
There's a winter storm warning in effect for practically all of Wisconsin. Snow, freezing rain, sleet, and heavy winds are expected through tomorrow morning. Some parts of the state could see 6 to 10 inches of snow. Highs will be in the 20s, except a bit warmer near Lake Michigan at 30 degrees. For tomorrow, a chance of snow and light freezing rain through the day, and a slight chance of light freezing drizzle in the afternoon and evening.
Support for WPR comes from Five Nines, a Wisconsin-based cloud service provider offering IT consulting, management, and hosting for user devices, applications, servers, and networks. Online at the number 5nines.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
In a few minutes, some sobering statistics about forced labor, even slavery.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Epson. With the new EcoTank line of SuperTank printers, these all-in-one printers feature refillable ink tanks that come with up to 2 years of ink in the box. Where there's business, there's Epson. Epson.com/forbusiness.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. The wholesale price of oil had rallied before Christmas, but not today, with crude in New York down 3%. About $37 a barrel now. Stocks are slumping to start the week. Let's do the numbers. The Dow's down 53 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ Composite down by a similar percentage. The S&P 500 down 0.5%. Instead of having a December 28th discussion, let's have a 2016 discussion with Lindsay Piegza, the chief economist at Stifel Nicolaus. For her, next year will be about the Federal Reserve's second act, now that interest rates were lifted for the first time in nearly a decade.
We've been waiting for this move for years now. Now, the chairman did try to downplay the 25 basis point increase, saying don't overemphasize the liftoff. It's all about the long-term pathway of rates, but there's a big question mark around what the Fed is going to do with rates in 2016. We do expect the economy to be relatively moderate, but I think at this point moderate will be good enough to hammer out at least two, maybe three additional rate hikes over the next 12 months.
What is the cause of your caution here? I mean, I cover it day in, day out, but the economy does seem like it's getting stronger. You're saying keep an eye out.
By the Fed's own characterization, the economy remains moderate. It's a little bit of a double-edged sword here because the Fed has initiated the first rate increase in years against the backdrop of an economy that's just so-so. So they typically describe the economy as robust. But this time around, they said, well, the economy's moderate. Let's start liftoff, but look for a very slow, steady, gradual increase. So there really isn't the type of robust activity that you would expect in an economy for the Fed to initiate early onset of rate hikes.
All right. Lindsay Piegza, chief economist at Stifel Nicolaus, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, while he swore a medium would fit, by now we know it should have been an XL. Of all those gifts we bought online, many are being returned now. For the post office, 600 million packages were delivered between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And if history is a guide, about 10% will be returned. Sally Hership says more.
It's not just you and that special Christmas sweater. Satish Jindal is president of ShipMatrix, their research and consulting firm on transportation logistics. According to his calculations, 62 million packages will be returned in January. And he says the Postal Service will be helping with more than 50 million of them. That includes packages consumers send, as well as returns the USPS helps FedEx and UPS make. He says the USPS has an advantage.
By far, they are the largest because they go to every address every day.
Jindal says just remember how many packages the USPS delivered before the holidays. Returns are a lot easier. Jarrett Streben is founder of EasyPost. It helps e-commerce companies get their packages shipped.
The other nice thing about returns is they're not date sensitive.
Streben says after the holidays, the Postal Service is also handling new deliveries from all those gift cards and holiday cash.
People have extra money after the holidays, and so they buy more stuff online.
Which the USPS knows. It's hired an additional 30,000 seasonal workers. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace's coverage of wealth and poverty issues is supported by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. More at fordfoundation.org.
Today, South Korea and Japan reached a landmark agreement to resolve the issue of South Korean women forced to work in Japanese brothels during the Second World War. The leaders of both countries said today they see this as an opportunity for closer ties going forward. Forced labor, slavery, the numbers, even as we go into 2016, are deeply disturbing. Stefan Richter, editor-in-chief of The Globalist, from time to time compiles some numbers so we better understand our world. Thank you for doing this, Stefan.
Good morning, David. I'm wondering, with you, which country today has the largest number of unfree people? Is it Nigeria, A, B, Mexico, C, India, or D, Russia?
This is a tough question. I'm just going to hazard a guess. Would it be India?
You are exactly right. It is India. India has 14.3 million Indians who are victims of modern slavery. Mind you, the definition in the modern economy includes examples such as women who are tricked into migrating for ultimately non-existent jobs, who are then forced to work in brothels. Household workers, same thing, promised work and then work without wages. Or those famous child soldiers who are forced to fight for certain military groups.
Stefan, where are you getting this data?
I'm getting this from the Walk Free Foundation's Global Slavery Index. And I should tell you and the audience that it is a slightly larger number than what the ILO, the famous international organization, has. According to them, there are 21 million people worldwide who are victims of forced labor and slavery. The Walk Free Foundation puts them at 36 million people, but I think it is economically more inclusive and reasonable to have this broader definition.
Now, you offered some other countries. How do they rate according to these definitions?
Nigeria was in there, and it has about 800,000 people that are part of modern slavery. That's just 0.5% of Nigeria's people. Mexico, I mentioned as well, 0.2% of the Mexican population are considered modern slaves. Russia has the largest incidence of modern slavery of any European or more specifically Eurasian nation. 0.7% of Russia's population are considered modern slaves. Fortunately, much less in terms of domestic forced labor than in the truly dark times of the Soviet Union, but still a point of shame in the world today.
All right. Well, we'll put up a link to this data set at marketplace.org. And Stefan Richter tweets at The Globalist. Stefan, thank you.
Thank you, David.
And a European Union official is reportedly calling for action on something that quietly adds to the annoyance of air travel. You can't take water through security. So if you want to hydrate on the flight, you have to pay airport prices for the bottled water. The EU's transport commissioner is quoted as saying there are talks about this with European airports. Sure, you can bring empty bottles to scan at security and fill them once inside, but ever try to top up the bottle at a drinking fountain? And sure, there are faucets in the public restrooms, but I don't know, right? In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you heard it on Wisconsin Public Radio, where there's more news for you today. We'll bring you headlines at noontime from NPR and from WPR. And then there's more in-depth news this afternoon on All Things Considered that starts at 3 o'clock. And you can always check WPR.org.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Security Health Plan, offering a variety of Medicare coverage options, including a Medicare supplement plan, available statewide. Information is available at securityhealth.org.
Support comes from Gateway, offering pathways to high-in-demand IT jobs that include network security and software and web development, starting pay $50,000 to $70,000 a year. 1-800-247-7122. Choose option 2 and ask for a new student specialist.